It's Wednesday, May 31st. They said there was no one left. They were wrong. We start here. After officials said no one was trapped inside, rescuers pull out one survivor, and now they're looking for more.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
She is alive.
How did they get it so wrong, and who can residents trust now? He admitted he gunned people down, but that didn't stop him from pleading not guilty.
Bauer's defense team called his actions inexcusable.
The trial over the Tree of Life synagogue shooting gets underway, and a court says the family behind OxyContin can't be sued over it.
It does raise questions. Serious questions.
The dramatic reversal and what it means for the opioid crisis. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
Pray for them people. And everybody's okay.
When an apartment building collapsed in Iowa this weekend, the immediate question was, is there anyone still trapped in that rubble?
There was a lot of screams, a lot of cries. A lot of people saying help.
I saw some apartments had water coming out from under their doors. There was a lot of dust and debris.
The answer, officials said, was pretty simple. The entire building had not come down. Several people had evacuated. One was pulled out. And sniffer dogs and thermal imaging were deployed to make sure no one else was inside.
Do you know that there are still people trapped?
I have no known individuals are trapped in that facility.
They were so confident, they planned to demolish the rest of the building. And so attention turned to a new question, what caused the building to give way? Which was confusing to some folks in Davenport, Iowa, who still hadn't definitively heard every resident was accounted for. What about pets and belongings, they thought?
I'm hoping they bring my dog out and that she'll come back out to me. She's my world.
Well then, as people looked up at that building, someone saw movement behind an open window. A woman was in there. As she was lowered down, a new question instantly arose. How did this building almost get demolished with someone inside? Well, yesterday, officials got together and admitted not only was that survivor overlooked, but there might be other people left as well. ABC's Alex Perez is still there in Davenport, Iowa. Alex, what the heck is going on there? Like, who is the survivor, first of all?
Yeah, Brad, just a really stunning turn of events here. The survivor's name, Lisa Brooks, she was on the fourth floor of the building on the side opposite of the collapse.
Did you hear it when it collapsed?
No.
Were you?
I did not hear nothing. If they were bulldozing, I was in a tub of sleep.
She was basically inside of her apartment for more than 24 hours until she was able to find her cell phone. She had misplaced it. She found her cell phone and called her daughter, and her daughter called authorities.
I just couldn't, I was just so afraid that I was going to die and don't see my kids.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh.
She is alive.
And then that led, of course, to first responders getting on the scene very, very quickly. Firefighters used a ladder to get up to the fourth floor, and she very happily was coming down that ladder and happy that she was finally found and getting to safety. But a stunning turn of events. Officials first tell the media and everyone else that they believe everyone is accounted for, and then all of a sudden they backtrack, and it turns out everyone is not accounted for.
A very happy event. Miss Lisa Brooks was rescued from the fourth story of the building. I am so thankful that she was found safe and alive.
Police say, officials say there's at least five people that are unaccounted for. Two of those five, they believe, are still inside of the building.
We understand that this is an unthinkable situation, especially for the families that are involved and impacted by this event.
How would there be more, not just one more person, but several more people? Like, how would these people have not gotten spotted the first time? Did they explain that?
Specific answers as to how we ended up in this situation, the mayor himself said, and I quote,
I don't know. Believe me, though, I want to know. Okay? And so does everybody else.
He said they're trying to figure that out still. But among the issues that authorities are having is that there are conflicting lists of people who lived in the building.
So our numbers were around 53 for the tenant list. We know that there's 80 units in that building. So again, we got three different sources of people who lived in that building, and that's where we cross-reference our lists.
Some people, believe it or not, he said, did not have cell phones, so reaching them was an issue.
Keep the building standing! Save our friends and family!
And it wasn't really until family members of the people who are still unaccounted for decided to show up on site and protest and demand that their loved ones be looked for, that authorities started to take a second look at all this.
So understand, it's not that we don't want to do this. It's the fact that we have to do it in a safe manner. And at this point, we're going to reevaluate how safe we can be in order to get in there and not currently make the situation any worse.
That building, the process of demolishing it was already supposed to have started. Now that's been put on hold until authorities say they can figure out a safe way to continue searching in that building.
Well, the most likely place to start demolishing that building is probably in the area of the debris pile, which unfortunately is the area of concern with respect to victims.
There's a lot of concern because authorities say the building is very unstable. They believe it could come down at any second, at any moment.
The debris pile itself is helping to hold the building up. So you want to do that with care.
So getting in there and searching through anything is going to be a very meticulous, careful process.
Yeah, and you mentioned kind of the community. And I mean, the community at this protest, which, by the way, was happening before that woman even appeared in the window. If they were frustrated before they knew they had confirmation that there was at least one survivor in there, what has the reaction been like since then?
Yeah, well, frustration here has really now turned to anger.
If the city knocks down the building and there are people in there, the city is killing them.
They feel vindicated that they did not give up their search for their loved ones and continued to protest and fight and make their voices heard.
This is my nephew's apartment. And up there where you see those clothes hanging neatly, that was his apartment.
Who's your nephew?
Brandon Colvin.
A woman named Johnny Woods. She is the aunt of one of the two believed to still be in the building.
Both of their cars were out here. They had to have their cars towed. So what is, they walked away?
She has been nonstop at present at the site trying to bring attention to her nephew. She knows that he would not just disappear, she told me, and she believes that he's somewhere inside that building.
We're waiting on you out here! Ryan Hitchcock! Brandon Colvin!
It was thanks to her persistence and the persistence of several other protesters and people that authorities are taking a much closer look at everything now, and that demolition of the building has been put on hold.
All right, Alex Perez, there in Davenport, Iowa. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, they can finally face their attacker in court, but they're split over what should happen next. The Pittsburgh synagogue shooter goes before a jury after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November, and while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Nearly 5 years ago, we witnessed the most deadly attack against American Jews in our country's history. A man with a semi-automatic rifle and several handguns walked into the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh during Sabbath services and opened fire.
I immediately announced to my congregation, drop to the floor, do not move, don't utter a sound.
11 people were killed. Yesterday, in the final week of Jewish American Heritage Month, the trial of a suspected shooter began. ABC's Ariel Reshef was in the courtroom. Ariel, I mean, we heard opening statements and even some witnesses so far, right?
We have, Brad. It was really an emotional first day in court. The judge read the instructions to the jury. It's a jury of 11 women, 7 men. And then the prosecutors began with their opening statements by introducing the court to those 11 victims you mentioned. They range in age from 54 to 97. Prosecutors then described in graphic detail how Robert Bowers, the suspect here, methodically scoured the Tree of Life Synagogue, armed with 3 handguns and an assault rifle, and opened fire on congregants at close range.
The only sounds I heard were the sounds of the people as they were being slaughtered.
They also told jurors about the anti-Semitic and anti-immigrant rants that Bowers had posted on the website Gab leading up to the shooting, and about his vitriolic post just minutes before he entered that building, saying, "I'm going in." Prosecutors played gut-wrenching 911 calls from 84-year-old Bernice Simon, who was huddled with her husband Sylvan as he bled to death before Bowers allegedly killed her while she was still on the line with first responders. And Brad, this was the sanctuary where the two had been married decades before.
So the defense is looking to prove that it wasn't based on a specific reason.
Bowers' defense team called his actions inexcusable, but urged jurors to consider and scrutinize the intent here.
Later at the sentencing phase, that's when we're going to hear more about the mental defect that they're alleging is there and present in Mr. Bowers, and what means that he cannot have the required intent.
The defense really centralizing his intent as we move forward in this trial.
I was going to say, so it's not necessarily at this point a question of whether he pulled the trigger. This is a question of whether he should be held responsible for the murder in the way the prosecutors are saying.
That's right, Brad. All of this is building up to a death penalty phase of this trial. Essentially, the defense team has acknowledged that Bowers is essentially guilty. They wanted a plea deal, in fact, where he would plead guilty in exchange for avoiding the death penalty. And some members in the community actually supported that in the Jewish community because they felt that that would also help them circumvent the pain of reliving and relitigating all of this tragedy.
People who lost their loved ones, the people who witnessed, have thought about a trial and justice process probably every day since the attack happened.
But in the end, prosecutors felt very strongly, and many members of the community felt strongly, that Bowers needs to see justice here and that the death penalty should remain on the table.
I was going to say, what is the atmosphere like there among survivors and family members? What does this trial 5 years later, nearly 5 years later, mean to this community?
As you know, Brad, the Jewish community is not a monolith, and the same can be said for the grieving community here in Pittsburgh. There's been a lot of healing underway here.
Healing is not a linear process. It has ups and downs. But over the long term, we know that resiliency is evident in things like the transformation of the Tree of Life building into an organization that's really going to help fight anti-Semitism.
And I was just speaking with a leader in the Jewish community who said that there are so many different organizations that have been founded to spread light since this tragedy. But as far as the atmosphere goes surrounding the courtroom and the trial, the families have largely kept to themselves, many of whom have witnesses within their families that have been instructed not to speak to the media. But what we are hearing is that there is a bit of a divide or a bit of discourse about whether or not this kind of trial draws attention to the kind of hateful ideology that the suspect here espoused. There's concern that it could create a security issue, but there's also a lot of hope that bringing these kind of issues to light and shedding light on the fact that anti-Semitism is not an abstract concept, it is venomous, it is dangerous, and it can be deadly It's important to shed light on that and show the real consequence of unmitigated hate.
Really interesting. All right, Ariel Reshef there in Pittsburgh. Thank you so much.
You bet.
When we think about the opioid addiction crisis that has claimed so many lives, we often think of heroin and fentanyl. But remember, many opioids are prescribed by doctors, and in the world of legal opioids, Purdue Pharma, the original maker of OxyContin, is a central figure. So obviously, it was a huge deal a few years back when Purdue Pharma and the government agreed to a bankruptcy settlement in which Purdue would cease to do business, its owners would agree to pay out billions of dollars to plaintiffs and lawsuits, but the deal also held that the Sackler family, who controlled this company for much of its existence, would be shielded from any personal liability in future lawsuits.
How can you possibly blame the victims for something you created, manufactured, and marketed?
People were outraged. A judge thought this deal was so ridiculous she refused to allow it to go forward. Well, yesterday, a federal appeals court revisited this case, and it sided with the Sacklers. ABC senior investigative correspondent Aaron Katursky has been watching this play out for years. At this point, Aaron, can you just walk me through this ruling yesterday?
This ruling is from the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, Brad. And it says, Brad, that yes, there can be shields given to people associated with a bankruptcy, even if those people themselves are not declaring bankruptcy. So in this case, Purdue Pharma declared bankruptcy, and the Sackler families are the ones that get the protection of that bankruptcy. A U.S. District Court judge back in late 2021 said that is just not the way it should be. But the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals disagreed and said plainly that these legal protections are allowed. And the ruling was blunt, saying that, you know, it does raise questions, serious questions, it said, about the purpose of bankruptcy and who it benefits and what its intent should be. But the judges said they weren't there to answer those more thorny questions. They were there to just say, are these kinds of legal protections allowed or not? And in the case of the Sacklers, they are allowed.
Wait. So Purdue Pharma, which for years, and they've admitted this now, aided and abetted pill mills and shady doctors, and they withheld information about their own drugs from the country, that they weren't telling people how addicted they knew they would get. The Sacklers were not just shareholders of this company. They were involved with this company, right? So going forward, as long as they pay this money, they can never be sued personally again for any of this?
They were the company. The Sackler families controlled this you know, private company, and they were the ones that made decisions that cities and states and people hooked on opioids said, you know, were responsible for a crisis that has claimed, what, 500,000 lives over the last decade plus. And in fact, the Sacklers, when they were figuring out how to you know, settle this, said, well, we're willing to pay billions of dollars. By some estimates, it's $6 billion that the Sackler families will contribute to this settlement for, you know, all across the country. But in order to get the money, then they want to make sure that they are inoculated from future litigation. And so it's, I've heard the comparison, it's like there's a fire and the Sacklers have the hose. And they say, well, we've got a hose, but if you want it, we're only going to, you know, give you the hose to put out the fire if you stop asking questions, stop investigating us, and stop threatening us with litigation.
Right. They're offering something here, basically, but it only goes forward if they're treated like a company that's bankrupt, right? Like where everything's wiped out, you can't take any more because it's all gone.
That's right. And in order for the bankruptcy to get done and for this money to get released, the Sacklers have always argued that this was the best way to do it. We know that these cities and states need the money. Let's get it moving. And a lot of cities and states, frankly, Brad, agreed.
I know that today isn't everything that we would have liked to have seen in terms of justice. I do believe it is the most we could expect and get under the law as it currently exists.
There were a few holdouts. States like Connecticut, for example, said, no, we get the offer, but we think there's more there. There's a terrible crisis, right? A crisis that's largely of Purdue's own making and other companies, but in this case, you know, Purdue and OxyContin. It only intensified during the COVID-19 pandemic. And a lot of jurisdictions were reeling and saying, you know, how do we pay to mitigate all this? And the Sacklers said, well, we'll give you some money, but only if you promise to cut out any future litigation. And some jurisdictions agreed, and a few said, that's just not right.
Yeah, the question of how much money do you want versus how much responsibility do you want to be taken? How much do you want to tell other families around the country that they will be besmirched forever if they try to do something like this? The Sacklers, for their part, by the way, have denied any personal wrongdoing. Aaron Katursky with this controversial ruling. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, that scale by the airport gate, it's not just for luggage. One last thing is next. One last thing. The holiday weekend was a record setter for airlines. The TSA screened more people than any Memorial Day weekend in history, pandemic or not. One of the anxieties for people was whether they'd be subjected to extra fines over their luggage. In fact, one person recently posted a clip of one of these disputes over bag size that went viral.
Her bag literally fits.
And part of me is always like, come on, how much space do airlines really need in the cargo compartments? While we're at it, do they really have to charge us for bags that weigh 51 pounds? Like, these planes are huge. Well, I promise to never ask those questions again if you promise not to subject me to this. Yesterday, Air New Zealand announced they will be weighing passengers before they depart Auckland International Airport for foreign flights. This is not to charge people by weight or anything. It's part of a survey where national air regulators want to weigh everything that comes on board, from cargo to people to the meals that are loaded into the galley. So the way this will work is before you step on the plane, you'll be asked to put your carry-on bag on one scale, yourself on another. There won't be a display. Your weight isn't getting shouted to anyone. In fact, Air New Zealand says its employees won't even be able to see the passengers' weights. They'll just get anonymously added to a spreadsheet, then off you go. Why is this all necessary? Well, weight does, in fact, make a huge difference on flights. In fact, according to the FAA here in the States, your average aircraft is designed with so many seats and such large cargo areas that if everything was full, the plane would be grossly overloaded. People or luggage, you gotta prioritize one, which is why budget airlines are so strict about bags and why some airlines, like Samoa Air a decade ago, experimented with charging people based on their weight. Never caught on, though, because it turns out we don't like being treated like cattle, let alone like luggage. Air New Zealand, by the way, says if you really don't want to participate, you can refuse. Although, then you step back and you go, I'm going to be flying over the Pacific Ocean for like 12 hours at a time. I guess you really want to make sure everything's in ship shape, I suppose. Hey, if you're enjoying this show, make sure to hit that follow button, subscribe for a new episode every day. So convenient. No weight requirement. You don't need to be this tall to ride this podcast. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.